You will now be placed into conference.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
Mina?
Yeah. Mina Sendai, Tom Krebs, Chris Seifer, and Clara Marin.
Okay. Hi. You have Eric and Jessica and Rebecca Kinburn from Paul Weiss. Fred Marcuse.
Hi, Fred Marcuse from Kay Scholler, representing Scott Eichel.
Fred, nice to meet you by phone.
Very nice to meet you.
And Scott is in the room as well.
Hi, how you doing? Scott Eichel here.
Hey, Scott, how are you? Have they told you that this interview will be recorded?
Yes.
Okay, good. Scott, we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and it's our job to report to the American people the problems relating to the financial crisis. And we are looking at Bear Stearns, but I would particularly like to take a line of questioning with you today that while it involves Bear Stearns, we have, you know, we would like to get into it. We're at, also, I should tell you at the outset of these proceedings that under 10 U.S.C. 1001, that it is a crime to lie to us, in that we are federal agents. Excuse me, that's 18 U.S.C. 1001. You understand that, Scott?
I understand, and hopefully I can help you out.
Thank you, Scott. Would you please kind of give us a thumbnail of your work history at Bear Stearns?
Sure. Going back, I was an intern at Bear Stearns for two summers, and then started there in the summer of 1997 as something called a reverse engineer, or basically just a fancy term for an analyst. It went on the trading desk, non-agency mortgage trading desk in 1998. Then started trading asset-backed securities as well. I was named head of credit trading for the mortgage department in 2002 or 2003, I believe.
In that capacity, how many people reported to you as head of credit trading?
Head of credit trading, only a couple of traders.
Okay.
And then I believe my last job was in December of 2007, where I was named co-head of the mortgage department.
Was there a point in time when you were dealing with the CDO group?
The CDO group is, you know, they're a banking group, and I'm you know, obviously part of the trading group. I did have people reporting to me who trade CDOs in the secondary market.
All right.
Who was the other co-head of the mortgage department with you?
At the end, Josh Weintraub.
Were you involved with the pricing of mortgage-related securities while you were there at Bear Stearns in your latter days?
Just to be clear, like, from the new issuance side, or from just like pricing securities for like a month-end valuation?
Well, let's try month-end valuation first, and then we'll get to new issue securities.
In my earlier days, when I was actually a line trader, yeah, I would be, you know, at the end of every month, we would be responsible for pricing securities. Later on, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, Bear Stearns actually had a pricing group called Pricing Direct, and they handled most of the pricing inquiries.
Was that true when you were dealing with non-agency mortgages, or was that going back to 1998, or when did that program start?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say it was more in the later 2000 period. If I had to guess, take an educated guess, I would have said probably somewhere around 2005 or maybe early 2006.
And in connection with that pricing, would they do the pricing for all of the various departments there at Bear Stearns?
The goal, the goal was to do that. They were, I believe, closer to the end, they were pricing actively for the mortgage department, the corporate department, and treasuries. I'm not sure if they got into munis yet.
Were they responsible for the development of pricing models?
You know, probably not. They would use the models that strategy or research developed.
But they, rather than the traders themselves, would go out and price those securities. Is that correct?
They would try to their best of efforts to price securities. The traders would give them information such as potentially pricing grids, or if there were hard to value securities, then they would fall back into the trader's lap probably.
Hey, Scott, this is Chris Seifer. We've heard from some other folks that what all the folks would do to value the trading book and to get the marks was they would simply get information from the five big investment banks, of which you guys were one, and simply use the average if you couldn't just look at the exchange and see a daily price. Is that something that was going on at Bear, do you know?
Sorry, when you said they would look at the five investment banks, what particular clients are you talking about?
You mean which banks am I talking? You know, Goldman, Morgan, Merrill, you guys, and Lehman.
No, I apologize. Sorry, not the five investment banks who they would get it from, but I'm saying who's the end user in your scenario. I'm sorry.
Well, when you guys are marking to market your trading book, whether it's and for, I guess, all the level one assets, you don't need to do that because you've got all you know what the price is. You just look at the market. But I suppose for level two and three assets, you would get, either a bid ask or something from the various broker dealers to make your mark. Is that something?
Okay, sorry. So you're talking about for our marks.
Right. Correct. Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
We're talking outside marks. Okay. Sorry.
Well, I think what he was asking was.
So go ahead. Is that how you guys would come up with your marks?
No. Our marks would, our marks, each individual trader is responsible for marking their books.
Okay. And so how would you guys go about marking your books, given the fact that you guys also had this this pricing group?
The pricing group, is a outside vendor for customers, all of money managers, hedge funds, banks, and insurance companies. The actual securities that are in ownership of Bear Stearns, or, for example, that are on repo, have to be priced by, the person who's actually trading book it was in, or, for example, in the repo book, would have to be priced by a trader who had the expertise in that particular area.
And how would the trader go about pricing?
Okay, so obviously, the most important thing would be any trades that they can relate to in the current marketplace. So from the first most important thing, a trade in that security or like security. For example, if you had security 2006-1, the triple B, that would be great if you could price that first. And then if you couldn't find that, if 2006-2 or, the one before in the end of 2005, you would try to price a like security. The other way so actual trades that you've done, also color in the marketplace from customers or trades they've done, or there's also obviously a broker's broker market where investment banks are doing trades with each other, so you can get color that way. And then if really you had nothing to that like, at the end of the day, back to I think maybe where you were going before with modeling, you could use your model that basically if you traded a like security and you traded that security to the model to, let's just say, a 6% return, then a trader might price a like security to the same scenario to a 6% return, obviously adjusting it for proper risk, reward, and leverage of that particular security.
Okay, thank you. Now here comes the memory test question. And focusing on 2007 and in particular before the two hedge funds blew up in July, do you recall if the marks were going down in the first half of 2007?
This is Eric. Tom, when we set this up, this was a 10-minute call focused on the subjects of the questions that were asked about for Tom Morano, and we were then told by Mina the next day that we wanted to have them asked of Scott. This is a very, very different set of questions that, frankly, we've not talked to Scott about. We're happy to make Scott available, but we were specifically told the purpose of this call and this interview was to address those subjects.
We will move to those subjects, but if Scott remembers this, and this is just probably the last question we have in this area.
Okay, yeah, I was giving you latitude because I thought you were moving on.
Yeah.
But after getting more of the memory test, you know, again, it's just not what we were told the call was about. But Scott, if you still have a question, if you know what that was, if you know the answer, for sure, go ahead.
Sorry, can you just repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Sure. In terms of the marks on the trading book or on the collateral secure in the repos, do you recall if the values were going down in the first half of 07 before the hedge funds blew up in July?
I believe, if I recall, there was two periods. There was a down period from January 07 to probably about March, and then there was an upward period from to about the hedge fund time. Probably March or April to the hedge fund time.
Okay. Okay. I'm happy to move on since you guys didn't have time to talk to Scott about this. We might have a couple more questions on this topic. So, I apologize, you guys. This is Chris Seifert talking. I wasn't in on your earlier conversation, so I didn't mean to sandbag you or anything. Tell me if this is correct. I believe that the topic of the conversation or the interview was going to be the interaction with Mr. Paulson and his or with Paulson's people.
Understanding as well.
Right. Okay. So let's go there.
Let's go to that.
And I'll tell you, you know, what we, you know, some of the things we've seen that you may have seen are, you know, this excerpt from the Daily Beast that, of course, says that you, Scott, you know, had, I think, three different meetings with these folks. So I guess the first question is, can you just generally describe, you know, when you first had meetings with these folks and what they propose? And if you've seen the Daily Beast stuff, tell me if there's anything in there that's inaccurate.
I'm not sure what the Daily Beast.
it's excerpts from The Greatest Trade Ever. So I guess...
I guess we could if we refer to the book or whatever. We did. I do recall we did have three meetings with John Paulson. The first one I think was kind of an introductory meeting to kind of you know hear what he was all about, the trades he'd like to put on, and you know probably our thoughts on the market, just general market color and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The second meeting was, you know, we're obviously more familiar with each other, and I was exploring, you know, different, you know, ways to do business together. And then a third meeting was more of a challenging meeting. I believe he wanted one of our heads of research and strategy there, and, you know, it was more of a point counterpoint type of meeting, you know, discussing the merits of different trades and so on.
About when did these meetings occur?
I want to say throughout 2006. You know, the first meeting could have been early 2006, maybe late 2005. The second meeting towards the end of 2006, like probably, you know, call it.
If you're not sure, Scott, don't guess.
I'm not really that. My memory's not that great on exactly when the times were.
Okay, is it safe to say 06, or you're not? You're just really not sure.
You know, I'm not really sure. I feel that they're in 06, but could have one of touched 05 and one of touched 07, particularly maybe.
Okay.
And the third meeting.
Sorry, and that was the third meeting was the point counterpoint meeting. Sorry.
Okay, I take it at one of these meetings, or tell me, at any of these meetings, you know, do you or someone from Bear Stearns say we're not interested in doing these kind of deals?
Oh, okay, sorry. I think in the book it's referring to there was a in the second meeting we had, through part of the meeting, you know, John Paulson, I don't think it was a secret to anybody, that he was looking to, you know, place a short on the housing market or the subprime market. So he was interested in doing a CDO where he would take, you know, a synthetic CDO. So if you sold it, right, you would create a bunch of longs and shorts. If you did deals, you would have a bunch of longs and shorts. And he was interested in taking the entire short side of a trade. So we discussed with him, you know, kind of what that would entail, meaning would he manage the deal, would he take a slice of long risk in the deal, and so on, different, you know, questions you would ask someone if you were going to do a CDO with them.
Right, and understanding that that's how he wanted to structure the synthetic CDO, I mean, it's at least reported in the book, that it identifies you as being, you know, I guess the word they use was wary of that trade, and that you were worried that he would want especially ugly mortgages for the CDOs, like a better asking a football owner to bench a star quarterback to improve the odds as wager against the team. Either way, he felt it would look improper. I mean, are those accurate? I assume you've read the book. I mean, are the descriptions in the book about your reaction to these proposed deals accurate?
So I have not read the book. I have seen, I did see these quotes. So just to go back, so we turned down the deal, right? And the point was, to what your first part of your question was, he left us with the impression of, because of previous, you know, interactions with them, that they would either want our help to select the worst possible deals, or that I just had the impression that he would select the worst possible deals. And, you know, for us, you know, just to give you, you know, I'm sure this is redundant, so I apologize if it is, but, you know, if you look at the housing market since, you know, 1933 to 2006, late, you know, 07, it only went one direction. And if you look at the CMO market, it went, you know, it was a very, you know, profitable market for, you know, two generations to be on the long side of the market. So for me, for our business, you know, when we went into a trade, we hopefully had the intent of, you know, when we would do a deal, that we believe our business was built around the long side of the marketplace. And usually when you do a CDO, there are three counterparties, and the three counterparties are, one, you being the issuer, two, the CDO manager, and three, the end buyer, the customer's buying it. If you look at that and look at where their you know, basically intents or their interests are aligned, are for the deal to do well. Everybody hopes the deal does well. In this case, you're adding a fourth party, which is Paulson, whose intent that he wants to initiate a deal to maximize the deal doing poorly. And so therefore, for our business standards, you know, for our reputation, I just didn't feel that it made sense to do this deal.
Okay, and did you take the proposal up to somebody else within Bear, or do you just reject it out of hand at it sounds like meeting number two?
I rejected it out of hand just after meeting number two. You know, we walked back. His office wasn't that far from us. It was somewhere on Madison Avenue. So we walked back 10 blocks. We went upstairs, and the salesperson and the banker, you know, asked me, what do I think? Is there something to do here? And I just simply, you know, dismissed it, saying kind of in the words I've chosen for you guys, that we're not going to do it.
Okay, and when you say we and you're talking about the other two folks, who are they?
I believe it was Joe Evanshack and Jeff Hanks.
Is that Hanks?
Hanks, H-I-N-G-S-T. Yeah, and I just want to clarify something.
Sure.
You know, obviously, on any synthetic transaction, there's a long and the short. So we did do synthetic deals where obviously there were a short side that was created. And just to be clear, the reason why I'm comfortable with that is because the CDO manager always picks those assets and with the intent that they're going to perform as best as they possibly can. In this particular transaction, once again, is that the impression that I had that, you know, Paulson would be selecting the assets to perform as poorly as they can. So that's hence why it didn't make sense.
So was there any discussion about there being the quote-unquote CDO manager or portfolio selection agent other than Paulson or in addition to Paulson?
We just, it never got that far. The idea was brought up, and like I said, it was readily dismissed.
Okay. Now, was the, you mentioned you rejected it out of hand in meeting number two after walking back to the office. Was it discussed with anybody else at Bear Stearns who agreed that it should be rejected?
A guy who is my, kind of my second in command. We might have talked about it on the way back to the office, and you know, both of us agreed.
And who was the second in command?
Adam Siegel.
Okay. Did you ever talk to a guy named Ira Wagner about it?
It was funny. I know when you just asked before, Joe Evanshack was Ira's main banker. I couldn't recall when we were just talking about if Ira was in the actual the second meeting. So I don't believe I did. I just believe we dismissed it.
Okay. Perhaps Joe did, since Joe
might have talked
him.
To Ira about it. I'm sure he would have.
Okay. And I take it meeting number three didn't have anything to do with these kinds of synthetic CDO deals?
Yeah, no. It was strictly about the subprime market.
Okay.
Did Bear typically do synthetic CDO deals? I thought there was a bias against those at Bear.
I think in general, there wasn't a, you know, personally, there wasn't a love for, it just wasn't our core business practice. The deals we did, whether they were synthetic or cash deals, we tend to, like we talked about before, we wanted, long-term success, so we tended to stay with the same CDO managers, kind of repeat issuers. We tried to target a deal a quarter, but I think if you ask people about Bear Stearns, I don't think you would, they would characterize us as an ABS CDO, machine or anything close to that.
Did you ever use ACA as a collateral manager?
Sure, we did do deals with ACA.
Do you remember who you dealt with there in terms of individuals?
Sure, Laura Schwartz. Mm-hmm. She was the lead person we dealt with, and then on the obviously we dealt with her group on a day to day basis.
Okay.
What did you take notes of any kind during this second meeting?
I did not.
Do you recall if there any notes were taken? Were any of you were there with a couple of other guys? Were they taking notes? Do you recall?
Yeah. I don't think so.
Other obvious questions. When you get back to the office, do you type up an email saying, hey, we had this meeting and I rejected it out of hand, blah, blah, blah? I mean, if there's any documentation, we may ask the folks at J.P. Morgan to produce it.
Yeah, I don't believe so. I mean, it was kind of, just to be clear, it was kind of like I got back to my desk. I was going to the bathroom, and I remember the two guys came up to me and just said, what do we want to do?
and that was it. So I think it was a very open and shut thing.
What I'd like to get to is what precisely was said to you about the method for the selection of the assets to be contained in the proposed CDO?
I'm sorry. Sorry.
All right. What specifically was said to you about the method for selecting the assets to be contained in the synthetic CDO under the Paulson and Company proposal?
Sorry. You know, nothing that I can recall was selected about how they would do it. It was just, you know, call it trader's intuition or impression that I was left with.
Well, if you only give it an impression, why did you reject the deal?
Well, just like I told you before, that fact that if someone on the short side of the trade was going to select the assets, one would think, you know, just generally think they would want to select the worst assets.
So did Paulson, when he was coming to you with this proposal, did he told you that they would like to select the assets that would go into the synthetic CDO? Or you were just, it was kind of danced around, he didn't quite say it, but that was the impression you were left with?
I think it was, as the way you put it, the second one. It was, you know, there wasn't anything clear cut about it.
Was anything said about the person who would acquire the equity tranche in this proposal, or was a discussion held about that?
I believe, you know, we asked him if he would take certain slices of risk, I didn't get a straight answer either there.
I think it was reported in the book that Pellegrini said that they, you know, they would be willing to do that. Does that jog any memory bells?
You know, but I think why you know, why I didn't get a straight answer, because I think it was one of those answers where, yeah, if show it to us, if it makes sense, we would buy it. But that's, you know, not a yes or a no.
I guess that is one thing I forgot to ask. Who were the folks from Paulson that were in the meetings with you, or at least in meeting number two?
Sure. John Paulson, Paolo Pellegrini are definitely the two I can remember. I can't remember. Potentially a Brad Rosenberg was there, and a gentleman named Sihan, who I will not attempt to mispronounce his last name.
So four folks from Paulson?
I believe so.
Okay.
Was this the only occasion where you were approached by a short seller to talk to you about structuring a synthetic CDO?
No.
What was it about this interaction that, you know, was this different than how they usually went down?
No, I don't. I believe, just to be clear, we were very consistent. I believe I turned down every short seller to do a deal.
So who else?
Who else came to?
I believe before Paulson, Morgan Stanley Prop.
Anyone else?
I believe we potentially had conversations with Magnetar, but I think it became apparent at the time where our CDO bankers just knew that this was not our franchise. We were not going to do this.
All right, well, Mr. Eichel, thank you very much. We appreciate your time. I don't think we have any other questions.
Okay. Tom, would it be possible for you to give us a copy of the tape?
To do what?
It'd be great. I appreciate it.
What was it you just asked? I didn't hear you.
Oh, I asked if it would be possible to get a copy of the tape.
Of the recording tape.
Let us check. Let us check and see what the official situation is here. If they have no problem with it, we have no problem with it. We'll check and get back to you.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Sure. You got it.
Thanks.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, that's the end of the interview.
Thank you.